following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
In science, the second law of thermodynamics says, among other things, that without intervention, systems will move naturally from a state of order to a state of disorder. For example, consider how the coffee in your mug gradually becomes cooler as the heat in the coffee is transferred to the surrounding environment. The environment will never make your coffee warmer unless some outside force acts on your coffee, like a heating plate or a microwave oven. The same principle is applied in other areas as well. Think about a garden. What happens to a garden if you leave it untended? Eventually, it's going to be overcome by weeds, right? This principle can also be seen in organizations, in churches, and even your personal spiritual life. Without constant attention and maintenance, inevitably, you will begin to see a drift from order to disorder. We see a great illustration of this in the closing chapter of the book of Nehemiah, chapter 13. If you have a Bible handy, I encourage you to turn there right now. We're closing out this series we've been working our way through for the past few months, rebuilding the house of God. And we're closing out with a warning to any person or any group that desires to walk more closely with God. Because even the strongest commitment will require continual focus and accountability. Nehemiah's people had experienced revival and revitalization. We have seen them come to this mountaintop experience as a people, rebuilding from the rubble, that not only came to rebuild their city, that not only came to rebuild God's temple, but their souls were rebuilt. Their spiritual life, their covenant with God was reconstituted, and they were at a mountaintop experience. In chapter 13, we read, on that day, they read aloud from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, and there was found written in it that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever enter the assembly of God, because they did not meet the sons of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. However, our God turned the curse into a blessing. So when they heard the law, they excluded all foreigners from Israel. Now, it's a little unclear what the phrase on that day refers to, but most likely it refers back to chapter 12, verse 47, and the phrase in the days of Zerubbabel and Nehemiah. Under the leadership of men like Zerubbabel and then Nehemiah who followed him, the people of God had committed themselves to honor the word of God. That's what it means by the book of Moses. And also to walk in the ways of God, to walk in that special covenant that God had invited them to be a part of, where he would be their God, they would be his people. And that covenant spelled out ways they would live distinctly to demonstrate what it looks like to be a people set apart for God's own purpose. There'd be a difference in their lifestyle, a difference in their morality, a difference in their worship that marked them out as set apart for God. Now, as an illustration, specific mention is made to this command in the Mosaic Covenant that prohibited the Israelites from intermarrying with their pagan neighbors. In this instance, attention is drawn to the neighboring countries of Ammon and Moab. And we see this prohibition spelled out in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 23, verses 3 through 5. In fact, a lot of the language in verse 2 comes straight from that passage in Deuteronomy. Now, remember, as we've talked about a couple times in the past, this prohibition about intermarriage had almost nothing to do with race. A lot of times over the centuries, people have tried to use this as a prohibition against interracial marriage. This doesn't really apply because the Israelites and the Canaanites essentially were descended from the same ethnicity. They were all part of what's called the Semitic people group. Okay, so it's not actually a different race. And this is especially true of the Ammonites and the Moabites because they were descended from Abraham's nephew, Lot. And we read about that in Genesis chapter 19. You know, Abraham was the patriarch of the Jewish people. And Lot, his nephew, was the patriarch of the Ammonites and the Moabites. So this was not about race. Rather, the prohibition had nothing to do with race, had everything to do with culture and religion. The warning was that the intermarriage with people from ungodly cultures would lead to a dilution of the commitments and the lifestyles of God's people. It's the same principle we see in the New Testament when the Apostle Paul warns in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 about Christians getting entangled with non-Christians in marriages or business partnerships. Paul says, do not be bound together. Literally in the Greek it says, unequally yoked with unbelievers. And he goes on to explain why. For what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? Or what harmony has Christ with Belial? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? Or what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are a temple of the living God. And the point being that when you are, as a believer, as a person who's trying to walk with God, wrapped up in these close, intimate type relationships with someone who does not share those values and does not share those priorities, one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to be in constant conflict because you're being pulled in two different directions, or you're going to begin to water down your commitment to the Lord and to His Word in order to make peace and get along with this other person. So you're either going to have conflict or you're going to have compromise. Moab and Ammon presented a special challenge for the people of Israel because the people of both nations had stood against their Israelite cousins during the Exodus as the Israelites were traveling to the Promised Land. Both nations had refused the Israelites safe passage and trade as they tried to stage to get ready to enter the Promised Land. They'd asked for permission to pass through. Both countries had said, no way. In fact, they'd gone as far as the passage mentions to hire a false prophet named Balaam who attempted to place a curse on the Israelites on behalf of the Moabites and the Ammonites. Of course, as we're reminded here, God took what people meant for evil and turned it around and brought good out of it. And that's a good thing for us to remember. You know, what other people may mean for evil, God has a way in His greatness and His sovereignty of turning around and using for His glory. And that's just what He did in this situation. But as a result, the prohibition of Deuteronomy 23 placed a curse on both of those nations and blocked them from ever joining in God's covenant indefinitely. Actually, what it says in Deuteronomy 23 is they're prohibited to the 10th generation. But the idea being, nobody's going to keep counting that far, and so it might as well be forever. Compare that to as they came out of Egypt, and they were told that people who came out of Egypt with them could join the covenant in the third generation. In other words, there was a shorter time frame, hopefully about three generations, you've kind of assimilated in, you left your pagan ways behind, and you're ready to adopt the ways of God's people. But in Deuteronomy, there's no hope given. In fact, the traditional Jewish interpretation of Deuteronomy 23 was seen as prohibiting Moabite and Ammonite men from ever being able to join the community of the faithful. The women could join the nation if they renounced their pagan identity and embraced the God of Israel, as we see in the case of Ruth, who was from Moab. But the men were excluded. Now, the point in mentioning this prohibition is to remind the readers of the level of recommitment the returning exiles had made to God's covenant. They came back together and they had affirmed, we are going to be the people of God. We're going to live the way God calls His people to live. We're going to demonstrate the difference it makes to be in relationship with God. And so because of that, we can't have these compromising relationships that weaken that commitment, that pull us in all these different directions. We have to be totally sold out to God. However, the people's newfound commitment to God apparently lasted only as long as Nehemiah was still governor, and he was around to hold them accountable. Jump over to verse 6. We'll come back to the verses 4 and 5 in just a second. But in verse 6, we read, "But during all this time, I was not in Jerusalem." This is Nehemiah speaking. He says, "I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had gone to the king. After some time, however, I asked leave from the king," and he returns to Jerusalem. So after 12 years serving as governor of Judah, from about 445 BC to 433 BC, Nehemiah returns to his post as cupbearer for King Artaxerxes in Persia. I know it says king of Babylon, but that's because Xerxes controlled, the Persian Empire absorbed the Babylonian Empire, and apparently the capital of the Persian Empire floated around depending on what time of year it was. And so when he returned, Artaxerxes had set up shop in Babylonian territory. But he returns to his post with King Artaxerxes. Now, we don't know how long he stayed there, but at some point he asked for permission to go back to Judah. And that permission was granted. Now, it had to be before 424 BC because that's when Artaxerxes died. So somewhere less than a decade, he was away. And when he returns, he was shocked to find how far his people had drifted in his absence. Without a good leader to hold them accountable and help them stay focused on the right path, God's people had drifted into compromise. And that spiritual compromise was evident in several areas that Nehemiah mentions for us here in this chapter. One, a loss of focus can lead to corrupting relationships. Going back to verse 4. Now, prior to this, Eliashib the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, being related to Tobiah, had prepared a large room for him where formerly they put the grain offerings, the frankincense, the utensils, and the tithes of grain, wine, and oil prescribed for the Levites, the singers, and the gatekeepers, and the contributions for the priest. But during all the time I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I'd gone to the king. After some time, however, I asked leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem and learned about the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah by preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. It was very displeasing to me. So I threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room. Then I gave an order, and they cleansed the rooms. And I returned there the utensils of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense. So Nehemiah discovered that while he was gone, one of the priests who administered the temple had set up a kind of sweetheart deal with his old enemy, Tobiah. Now you may remember, Tobiah was an influential Ammonite who had married into the Jewish priestly family. Tobiah was also a major figure in the campaign to keep the walls of Jerusalem from being rebuilt. He was part of that gang of four that ganged up and tried to undermine the project. And as part of that campaign, Tobiah had been involved in conspiracies to entrap, undermine, or eliminate Nehemiah. This guy was bad news. He was a snake. And yet this priest, Eliashib, had set Tobiah up with an apartment inside the temple complex itself. Eliashib literally invited one of the community's chief antagonists to live at the heart of the community. Wow! To make matters worse, he had put Tobiah in a space that had been set apart for the specific purpose of storing resources in support of the worship at the temple. All that material was now displaced. Wonder where it went. The final insult was that Tobiah was one of those dreaded Ammonites whom Deuteronomy 23 had warned about. And here he was, in theory, excluded from the covenant, living inside the greatest symbol of that covenant at the temple. You know, and Nehemiah took quick action to dislodge Tobiah and reconsecrate the sacred space. He literally threw the guy out into the street. You know, we run into trouble when we allow ungodly influences to crowd into spaces that should be set apart and reserved for God. We need to be on our guard against those influences coming in and diverting our attention. We need to be against those relationships that pull us away from the path. We need to be careful about who we give influence to and responsibilities to. Churches are really, really bad about this sometimes. Now, you've heard me say many, many times, you know, one way to get people to, you know, connect and stick around is to help them build relationships and give them some responsibilities. And I believe that. Give somebody a job, you know, find something some way for them to plug in and meet people and work alongside people and develop those relationships. However, you got to make sure you match the right people with the right responsibilities. Okay, you don't want to put somebody who is spiritually immature or hasn't demonstrated good character in a sensitive position that requires spiritual maturity and good character. Okay, and churches do this, say, well, you know, man, so-and-so is such a good guy, but he just never really plugs into church. Maybe what we ought to do is give him, you know, make him a deacon or a Sunday school teacher. And trust me, you put the wrong people in the wrong spots, and it can come back to bite you in a very, very bad way. That's why in the New Testament, when deacons were selected, there was such a big emphasis in Acts chapter 6 about finding men of good character, full of the Holy Spirit, to serve in that capacity. Confidence was only one part of the equation. Their character and their spiritual commitment, their spiritual maturity, were major factors. When Paul gives the requirements for overseers and for pastors and for deacons later on, character plays a huge role in that, because character will trump confidence nearly every time. So we need to be careful about who we give influence to in terms of our communities. But not only do you have these corrupting relationships, a lack of focus also leads to financial neglect. Look at verse 10. I also discovered that the portions of the Levites had not been given to them, so that the Levites and the singers who performed the services had gone away, each to his own field. So during the time of national revival, the people had made a very public commitment to support the work of the temple and those who served in the temple through their tithes and offerings. They stood up and said, we're going to give. We're going to support all this. We remember in the end of chapter 10, we will not neglect the house of our God. However, that financial commitment had begun to wane, and many people had simply stopped giving. You know, that commitment was fine and dandy until the well dried up. And so, well, you know, I really got to dig a new well. Oh, well, you know, the wagon lost a wheel. We got to replace that. Well, you know, the roof's leaking. We got to take care of it. And isn't it interesting? We always find something else where we need to use that money, and we can't give what we promised to give God. And as a result, some of the Levites, you know, actually left temple service to find other work to support themselves. As Paul says in the New Testament, labor is worthy of his hire. These guys were tired of starving, so they went back to the farm. So who's going to serve the temple? Now, let me say, I have been blessed in my ministry that every church I have served has been more than fair with me. Okay, and I'm never going to get rich doing this, but I'm not going to starve either. Y'all treat me very well. Every other church I've served has treated me very well. But it's not like that with some of my colleagues. I know guys that are, you know, it's like their churches are trying to starve them out. The labor's worthy of his hire. And these Levites, because they couldn't support their families, they're leaving service, they're leaving ministry to go do what they got to do to take care of their families. So Nehemiah challenged the people to step up. In verse 11, so I reprimanded the officials and said, why is the house of God forsaken? Remember, the commitment was, we will not neglect the house of our God. And Nehemiah comes back a few years later and says, guys, was that just an empty promise? Why is the house of God forsaken? Then I gathered them together and restored them to their posts. So he goes to all the Levites that have scattered out, and he tries to convince them to come back in. Verse 12, all Judah then brought the tithe of the grain, the wine, and the oil into the storehouses. In charge of the storehouses, I appointed Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, Pedaiah of the Levites. In addition to them was Hanan the son of Zakur, the son of Mattaniah, for they were considered reliable. And so it was their task to distribute to their kinsmen. Remember me for this, O my God, and do not blot out my loyal deeds, which I have performed for the house of my God and its services. So Nehemiah challenged the people to keep their commitments, and then he placed reliable people over the management of funds. And that's so important. You know, I've said before, if we're going to ask people to entrust us with their donations, we need to make sure that we are as transparent as we can be about how those donations are being used, and that we are as transparent as we can be and being good stewards and not wasteful in how those donations are used. Now, we strive for that. We don't always get it right. There's probably a lot of things we could do to up our game in that area, but that's our goal. That is our intention. But as I've also said many times, money is fuel for ministry. We can't do what we do without you. There's nobody sitting behind us that's giving out free money to churches. Okay? It's the people in the church that help the church move forward. And thank you, those of you who give faithfully. We couldn't do it without you. So they challenged the people to give, and he placed reliable people over the funds to make sure they were used correctly. But without focus, people tend to find other places to invest their money. Without focus, there's also the danger of spiritual compromise. In verse 15, now in those days I saw in Judah some who were treading wine presses on the Sabbath, and bringing in sacks of grain and loading them on donkeys, as well as wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads. And they brought them into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. So I admonished them on the day they sold food. So one of the spiritual commitments that the people had made during this time of revival was to honor the third commandment and to keep the Sabbath day set apart for the Lord. However, when Nehemiah returned, he noted the markets were open even on the Sabbath day, the seventh day. That was a sign of the spiritual drift that had happened in the commitment of the people. The people had let the secular invade the space that should have been reserved for the sacred. He goes on to say, also men of Tyre were living there, who imported fish and all kinds of merchandise and sold them to the sons of Judah on the Sabbath, even in Jerusalem. So they allowed people from outside the community who weren't part of the covenant to come in, and maybe they themselves weren't selling stuff, but they let these guys come in, and they were all buying from them. Again, you know, we as believers and as 21st century Americans, we live under a little different expectation. But people talk about, you know, how it used to be all the stores were closed on Sunday, and now, you know, it's like Sunday's just another day of the week. And I guarantee you, if all the Christians got together and said, we're not going to go shopping, a lot of those shops would close up. You don't believe me? How many stores were open on Thanksgiving this year? You know, I remember the first time I ever went to a retail store on Thanksgiving. We were living in New Orleans at the time, so that means it was within the last 20 years. And I was like, I can't believe a store is open on Thanksgiving. And then within a couple of years, it was standard practice. Everybody was open on Thanksgiving. I have a daughter who works in retail. Let me tell you about it. I know about it. Having to schedule our Thanksgiving get-togethers around her work schedule for years. But guess what? People stopped going out to shop on Thanksgiving. So what did they do? They shut the stores down. Again, as Christians, we live under a little different expectation. I don't have time to go into all that this morning. But the stores are only open because people are willing to go shop. More importantly, we need to protect that which belongs to God and not let the secular invade it. Nehemiah confronted the leaders who were condoning this practice and reminded them this was one of the sins that had brought about the exile in the first place. In verse 17, then I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, what is this evil thing you're doing by profaning the Sabbath day? This was supposed to be a day set apart to worship God, to reflect on God's goodness, to rest, and to let the people who worked for you take a break as well. And instead, they were treating it just as any other day. So they cut out the time to look up, and they were just looking for the next buck. He goes on to say, did not your fathers do the same, so that our God brought on us and on this city all this trouble? And that goes back to 2 Chronicles chapter 36 verse 21, where the chronicler talks about, because of the Babylonian exile, the land finally had to rest. All those Sabbath days that they had skipped, God let the land rest for 70 years. And then he says, you are adding to the wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. So he confronted the leaders, and then he took steps to close the city gates to the merchants on the Sabbath day and warned them to respect the boundaries. And it came about just as it grew dark on the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I commanded that the doors should be shut and they should not open them until after the Sabbath. So they would shut the Sabbath on Saturday. They would shut sundown Friday night and not open again until sundown on Saturday. He didn't just shut the gates. He says he stationed some of my servants at the gate so that no load could enter on the Sabbath day. Once or twice, the traders and merchants of every kind of merchandise spent the night outside Jerusalem. So what happened was all these people from other countries that wanted to sell in Jerusalem, they just start camping out outside the city so they could be the first to rush in. It's kind of like Black Friday, you know? They're rushing in, getting ready to rush in to sell. And so verse 21, Nehemiah says, then I warned them and said to them, why do you spend the night in front of the wall? If you do so again, I'll use force against you. I think he might be a little serious about this. From that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come as gatekeepers to sanctify the Sabbath day. For this also, remember me, O my God, and have compassion on me according to the greatness of your loving kindness. So he took steps to close the city gates to the merchants on the Sabbath day, and then he recruited trustworthy people to help preserve that effort. He put other people in charge of it to make sure it continued to happen. Beware the temptation to compromise spiritual standards to satisfy material desires. There's an old story about a hunter who went in the forest to hunt a bear. Winter was coming. He thought what he needed was a nice bearskin coat to keep warm. And sure enough, he'd been out for a little while and he saw a bear coming toward him. So he raised his rifle and took aim. And the bear said, "Wait, stop! Why do you want to shoot me?" And the hunter said, "Because I'm cold." And the bear said, "Well, I'm hungry. Maybe we can come to some kind of arrangement here." In the end, sure enough, the hunter was well enveloped with the bear's fur, and the bear had a full belly. Let he who hears understand. The lesson, no matter what compromise you seek to make with sin, eventually it will consume you. So watch out for that kind of compromise. And then fourth, lack of focus leads to a loss of spiritual identity. In verse 23, "Now in those days, I also saw the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab." So Nehemiah observed that the prohibition against mixed marriages had not been observed. Ashdod was a Philistine community. It wasn't specifically one of the ones mentioned in Deuteronomy 23, but again, it represented a foreign pagan culture. And so as a result, the Israelites should not have had these kind of relationships with them. This had already been an area of major scandal during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah's first term as governor. If you remember, this has come up before, and they had a couple very public times of dealing with this. But here, without accountability, the people had begun once again to compromise on this issue. And again, it brought predictable results. Because the families in this scandal were diluting the spiritual identities of the next generation. We read in verse 24, "As for their children, half spoke in the language of Ashdod, and none of them were able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of his own people." So the children were being raised in these mixed culture households, and many of the children couldn't even speak Hebrew. You know what that means? That means they could not read their own scriptures. They were limited in their ability to understand the Bible as it existed in that day. And it probably means they weren't being immersed in Jewish culture as well. So they were growing up with, at best, a compromised sense of what it meant to be people of the covenant. And perhaps growing up with no understanding of that whatsoever. So Nehemiah decided he had to do something about that. Verse 25, "So I contended with them and cursed them and struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, 'You shall not give your daughters to their sons nor take your daughters for your sons or for yourselves.' Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin regarding these things? And yet, among the many nations, there was no king like him, for he was loved by his God and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, the foreign women caused even him to sin. Do we not hear that you've committed this great evil by acting unfaithfully against our God by marrying foreign women? Even one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was a son-in-law with Sanballat." Remember him, the Horonite? "So I drove him away from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites." So Nehemiah passionately challenged those who were involved in these compromised relationships. In fact, he became physically violent with some of them. Now, we wouldn't condone that. Maybe his passion got a little bit of the best of him here, but I think we may not approve his methods, but I think we can appreciate his passion and the intensity that he brought to this problem and the danger this form of compromise represented. He didn't just sit back and say, "Oh, well," he got involved. Godly leaders must address the loss of focus. Closing out in verses 29 to 31. Again, this prayer. "Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Thus I purify them from everything foreign and appointed duties for the priests and the Levites, each in his task. And I arrange for the supply of wood at appointed times and for the first fruits." In other words, he arranged for the supplies they needed to carry on worship. "Remember me, O my God, for good." So, what can we learn from how Nehemiah addressed this situation among his people? Well, first of all, he addressed it with openness. He didn't sweep it under the rug. He just didn't sit by passively. He openly attacked the issue. He pointed to the problem and said, this is not right. We need to correct this. He also addressed it with decisiveness. He took intentional steps to confront the issue and to hold accountable those who needed to be held accountable. He confronted it with wisdom. Is that maybe where he lost his temper and started pulling people's hair out? Most of the time, he approached this with a plan. Here's what we need to do to correct the problem. He approached the issue with integrity, above board, transparent. And that is so key. No business going on in back rooms. We need to do things with integrity and above board. And then, notice this most of all, he addressed this issue with a dependence on God. You notice how many times we're told Nehemiah stopped and prayed, God, remember me for this. God, help me with this. He didn't proceed on his own authority. He didn't proceed under his own power. But he took his direction from the Lord and he asked for God's help to face each of these issues. When I was in scouts as a teenager, one of the skills our leaders tried to impart to us was how to navigate on land using a compass. Now, there's a lot of aspects of that skill that I have forgotten because of lack of practice. But there is one thing that has always stuck with me. When you're navigating, it is important to designate spots along the way where you recheck your heading to make sure you are indeed moving in the right direction. Because as you travel, it is almost inevitable you will begin to drift off course. So stopping regularly to consult your map and your compass is imperative if you want to stay on the right course. The same thing is true in our spiritual lives. If we leave our spiritual journey up to chance, it's inevitable we're going to begin to drift off course. We need to stop regularly and check our bearings against the Word of God if we want to continue traveling in the right direction spiritually. How's your direction this morning? Are you making good progress toward the right goal? Or have little compromises along the way pulled you off course? The good news is that when we do get off course, the way to correct our course is much the same as when you drift off course in the woods. You go back, you figure out where you took the wrong step, you find the right bearing, and you head in direction to the goal. And if you're having trouble finding your spiritual bearing, let me give you a little advice. Always remember to look to Jesus, because He is both the destination and the path. As Hebrews 12 verses 1 and 2 tells us, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin that so easily entangles us. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand in the throne of God. That phrase there, the author and perfecter of our faith, is interesting. It basically means the one who has begun this race and has finished this race ahead of us. He already has blazed the trail. And when we are headed towards him, we find he is seated there at the right hand of God waiting for us. So as long as you're headed toward Jesus, you'll never be going in the wrong direction. Which direction are you headed today?
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.